Okay, welcome everyone to the last session of the second day in the Agile Developer track, and in a real switch up. Instead of Jim introducing the session, Jim felt.
Which I haven't done yet.
You have not done yet.
No.
So it's a real switch up.
Jim felt so strongly about this issue that he wanted to be on the panel. So we have assembled a diverse panel across all facets of Microsoft personnel in attendance. Okay, but they may agree on everything. They may not. I have a loaded question or two. So we're gonna start off with a couple of questions up here, and then I'll do my traditional thing of running a mic out to you guys so that you can ask a burning source or control related question. Okay. Now, when we're done, we're going to go across the around the hall to the dining hall and have the opening reception. And I think, are all four of you guys planning to be there as well?
Yes, sir.
So if there's a 3.5 people are going to be there, and we'll go from there. So first of all, you're all in favor of source code control, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yes.
Good. So what else should we control? Should you control stuff like binaries, documentation? What other things would you guys put in your source code control solutions?
Everything,
okay. Anybody want to go with a not everything?
So the thing I have some trouble with is I like to put the things into source control that make up the deliverable of the product. Okay. And often you have stuff which is like living documents that happen, like what the procedures are. You know, if you want to come in and you guys getting started, mm-hmm. then that to me doesn't live in source control. That's more of a wiki or a document in SharePoint or something like that. And some people want to check in all the documents that are related to projects, you know, and they might have like a big requirements document, which again, if you're starting off with a big requirements document, then one might argue probably not going to be overly successful anyway. But should that go in source control? Probably not.
Trash
maybe.
Can.
Yeah, trash can. Well, you've got to keep it somewhere in case you've got to get the lawyers involved afterwards. But yeah. So but sometimes there are documents that do belong in SharePoint or in a wiki. Don't you know? But it's the things that make the deliverable of the product is what needs to be source
how
control.
How do you tie that to the deliverable then? I mean, or do you ever need to do that?
I think that's the trick. I think it's if it's tightly coupled to the deliverable, it should probably be in source control. So, for instance, user documentation, which is part of the deliverable, probably would live in source control. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's like a procedures manual that, you know, is about how your team operates,
yeah,
source control might not be the right place for it.
I'd still put the procedures manual in there, because that way there's a single source of information for anything that a developer needs. So if a developer or other person who's comfortable with source control is going to be using it, then I put it in there.
I'd agree.
Assuming it's not created by a machine. You know, it's things made by machine are the things I don't put in source control.
I'd agree if you could search the documents in source control easily. See, that's one thing SharePoint does.
It's going to help us with that.
Yeah. It's on the backlog.
Which is in source control.
Yeah. So but the thing is, though, it's not. If you take a label of a product or whatever at a certain point in time, or you do a build, then what the developer procedures were at that point in time, they're not important, you know, to be archived at that point. So why have it in source control?
Well, does a build label add any overhead?
Well, no, but yeah.
Yeah, so you take a label or you take a fork, it's not
a big
deal.
Well, it's not necessarily the label. I think it's just what you might put in there. And I think the interesting thing is like wiki, like some type of living document. I question whether, you know, freezing it at any point in time and saying this was history on November 15th.
Yeah. That's no value.
How important is that?
It's not that I wouldn't do that for the value of having the history of where it was. I do that for the ease of finding whatever it is that I'm going to go towards. So like on my current team right now, we've got a set of things that are documented in a wiki. We've got a set of things that are documented in another wiki. There are a set of things that are documents on SharePoint. There are a set of specs that are checked in to a different source control system than the one that everyone else uses. There's a different set of specs that are checked in that are on SharePoint. And with all of those different places to look for something, when you want to go get a piece of information, it's not clear where it is. It's not clear how they tie it to each other, which ones are obsoleting, which ones, all of that sort of stuff. In teams that I've worked on previously where everything is source control and there is one true repository of the information, it's obvious.
Okay. Okay. So Arlo is strongly in favor of one repository to rule them all.
So where do you put a document telling people how to get where to get the stuff from source control?
Yes, on an index card.
It's on the back of your badge.
Yeah.
So type to your monitor.
Well, information radiator. So you have a single poster on the wall that says, here's where you check out source control.
Okay. So, now, specifically, somebody had asked about binaries. Do you put binaries in your source control system?
Mm-hmm. So,
as long as they weren't made by a machine. By a machine in my process.
Not built.
As long as they weren't built on my team. Yeah, I wouldn't do a built binary.
So external dependencies.
An external tool or an external library or whatever, I'd certainly check those out.
Yeah. But not libraries you've generated. We all agree that's generated. Actually evil.
Yeah.
Evil. Okay.
Oh, so, we have a question over here.
Already a question? That's great. I'm almost at the end. So,
I've heard this repeated by several people as gospel, and I want you to sincerely try to answer me here. Why?
Why is binary evil? Is that the question?
Yes. Why is it evil to check in binaries that your team is responsible for building?
So,
versioning strategy.
Yeah. Right. So I actually don't quite agree that it's full blanket evil. So I do think that there is one case in which it makes sense, and that is it can make sense to check in the releases. So when you make an official release, checking in the entire deployment package that will deploy that official release can make a lot of sense. It's not the only strategy I'll use. Sometimes I'll just put those on a file server somewhere. But other than that, I see it as evil because the point of source control is to be the living repository for all of the things that we're working with all the time. And stuff, a change in that is a change in something that matters. Whereas a built binary, it's going to show up as a diff, you're going to check it in just because you recompiled from the same source. There wasn't any change in the information content, just a change in some bits.
And I should be able to recreate that. I mean, if I can't recreate that binary, I'm screwed.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't matter if I have checked in one from a month ago. If I can't recreate it, I don't have anything.
Yeah, the other issue is if you're checking in every build, most of those builds aren't interesting. Yeah. If you're doing continuous integration, for instance, and you're building every hour, you don't need every hour of history since your project began, and that's what version control gives you.
And they don't go away. You know, I mean, you can destroy them, but they don't. The whole point of the version control tool is to try really hard to never get rid of something. And if you go checking in every single CI build, then it quickly expands and gets quite a large repository. But the other thing, if you're checking in every single CI build, you then do a typical thing for me is I come in the morning, because I work a different time zone to my colleagues, so I come in the morning and I do a view history on the repository to see what's changed. And I do a view history, and I see check in build, and it just adds noise to the repository that doesn't need to be there. If I'm doing diffs between versions, you always see the same binary show up, and it's just no value, because if your builds aren't repeatable, if you can't go to your build server and say, give me a build that was the state of the source control server at 10:56 on a Tuesday morning, then you've got it wrong, and you're going to have more trouble later. So it leads to laziness by checking them in, because people get into bad...
Also, source control system not so good at binary.
Many aren't.
Diffs, you're going to expand very quickly the amount of space needed if you're saving all.
Yeah, because the way source control systems work is some source control systems, like say Git, just store entire versions, whereas the way TFS works is it will compress down the deltas between versions, is how it compresses the repository. But for big binary files, if it's over a certain... Well, for binary files, it actually says, nah, that's a binary file. I don't want to do a diff, because there's no point. But if it gets... So when they get over a certain size as well, it decides not to, because it's a performance optimization. So don't do it.
We had another question right here, and then I'll probably open up for people in the back. So.
I'd like to add on to that. On a very large project with different teams, do you consider shared kind of interface binaries between teams as external and check them into source control?
So in our team, we do. I know in developer division, that's how we share contracts between different teams, is by checking them into version control. Again, it's so developers have a single point. They can sync that particular release or particular point in time, and they can build without having to grab the source for the external team and build it, without having to grab binaries off a network share and register them on their machine. They can just sync and build.
I would say I treat them exactly like I do an external dependency, but that doesn't necessarily mean source control exchange of binaries. So it might be that I take a periodic dependency on their nightlies or even on their official releases and just binaries. It might be that I have that we are strongly associated, and so I just take a source level dependency, and I just remain with the head of their source control. It depends on the interaction between the teams, just like it would depend on the interaction between me and an open source project out there.
So in the NuGet world, I'm not sure how it's working now. In the Maven world, I live in the Java world, so throw some other perspective in here. In Maven, Maven has its own repository, a bit like in NuGet. So, and you publish specific versions of binaries, and then during a Maven build process, you specify which version of the binary you want as part of the build, and you actually say, I'm interested in, 1.2.4.6. Or I'm interested in 1.star, and every time it does the build, it pulls in the latest version of 1.star, one that does that contract. And then when you do a release build is when you lock it into a specific version of the binary, and then that allows you to do it. So if you're going to treating contracts between teams or treating dependencies between teams as binaries and manage them as little mini releases, I think is a very good practice. And being able to say, yes, this is version 1.6 of my binary, and when I go to version 2, I'm doing a breaking API change or something like that. That's all a good practice. And maybe you do then need to check in their binaries into like an external library so that you can have repeatable builds easily.
But, and then I've done something similar to that with, so we had a framework, and then we had the things that used the framework. So what we did is, and they obviously change at varying levels. The thing that used the framework changed all the time based on functionality. Mm-hmm. The framework changed very, very, very few times. So what we did is we published a binary of the framework. They then used the framework, but then if we ever had to change it, then we would publish a new binary and then obviously go and update it.
But don't fall into the trap of thinking, right, binaries, external teams, I do a CI build, which revs the build number every time. I know, I need to check in all my my binaries.
Okay. Well, we had separate CI builds for the framework versus the applications.
Yeah. Now, we had a question up in the back, but I heard Arlo say, I might, and I might a couple times. And I was wondering about that. Sounds like a policy-related question. So why don't you guys rev on checking policies, especially for non-source control, and then I'll go up here and get the next question. Is that something you'd like to talk about?
So is it worth explaining what a check-in policy is, first of all? Is that worth me?
Yeah. That might help.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a check-in policy in TFS world is a piece of code that runs in the client before check-in, and it validates that the check-in is possible or not. An example is, has a comment been associated with this check-in? Another example, you could write any check-in policy you wanted. So another example might be, does this code pass all the FXCOP rules? Are there any FXCOP static code analysis rules which fail to prevent the check-in? So that's what a check-in policy is, first of all. Mm-hmm. And then, good or evil.
Certainly, I want to keep bad stuff out of source. So there is some sort of a policy, whether it's tool oriented or not, is a whole separate question. There are teams that are very, very successful with it's a manual policy of you got to build and run all the tests before you check in, but we trust you to have done so, and so you just commit. So, or you have to have done a code review or whatever else. I do think that each team does need to define its criteria for what is allowed before something goes into source control, because the objective is that source is always good.
I do think they find it usually demonstrates an extreme lack of trust. Because
if they're absolute and enforced.
And also, when I was a consultant before I worked at Microsoft, these are the things that get the most ingenious, you know, workarounds that you could ever imagine. You know, so you have to have a comment. So the comment is, I have to have a comment. Okay, I passed the check-in policy. So then, what do the check-in policy people do? They go write it and say it can't be. I have to have a comment.
Or it has to be greater than 50 characters.
Right, or it has to, you know, it's okay, well, okay, now we go back and forth. Oh, it's got to be greater than 50 characters. So it's 50 characters of crap now, or something like that. And it's, so oftentimes, the first thing I think of is we don't trust the people that are checking the code in. And the second thing is it actually causes this behavior, which I find really, really kind of is bad for the team perspective. So I don't know, that's my take on it.
I do find them a good reminder as well, though, because sometimes you'll just forget, especially if it's something not on that first screen. So maybe your policy is that you need to put in the code reviewer's name, and sometimes you just forget, and the check-in policy will pop up and say, you haven't entered a code reviewer's name. And most of the time, you've actually done a code review and you just put their name in. Sometimes you just go, it was me, and hit check-in anyway. But sometimes, especially when you're context switching a lot and you're busy... not from a policy perspective, but just as that little reminder that, hey, you got to do that.
Yeah. So I believe that with all power comes great responsibility. Mm-hmm. And one of my things, an anti-pattern I see a lot is, I go out and talk to people about TFS, and often you talk to source control managers and things, and they see check-in policy, and oh, fantastic. And like you
they
say, start writing all these rules, and oh, look at this, I can write all my own code, brilliant. I'll call some external system. And the thing I always try and emphasize is you want it to be as, while you want to make sure people don't check in code that doesn't compile, you also, that's just... If people do that, you give them the build monkey, or you give them a dunce's cap, you use peer pressure to stop them being stupid.
Right. That's what data check-ins for as well.
Well, yeah, exactly, and CI builds and things like that. But the check-in policies are useful as a little reminder for check-in comments. And one of the things that was done explicitly in the design of Team Foundation Server, which these SCM managers who love control hate, is that it says when you do a check-in policy, it says you haven't done the check-in policy, you know, and then there's a check button say override, but you have to leave a comment as to why you're overriding. So it's pros and cons, but just they can be useful. I personally prefer to have as many as I can not switched on, as few as possible. But just don't go crazy on them, and make it as easy as possible to check in, because you want check-ins to be fast, because you want your developers to check in often. And you want to encourage that kind of behavior. And the more check-in policies, the more obstacles you put in their way to check in, the less often they will check in. And that's bad.
Yep.
I was waiting for that pause. This is kind of a scenario question. I deal a lot with SharePoint and how we, use SharePoint as a product and creating different things with SharePoint. And one of the things that I run into a lot is sharing components among different team projects or different source control projects. What is the best practice or recommended practice that you guys would look up as, would you link it? Would you branch it? Would you put it everything into the other source control? Like what would you recommend for something like that? If I had one component that had to be shared by another team, how would I do that?
I treat it just like any other release of software between two people who may or may not be at the same company. You work with you decide with this other person what sort of relationship you're going to have. Are you going to have a supplier and consumer relationship? Are you going to have a partner's relationship? Are you going to have a tightly interwoven partner's relationship? And then you match your tool choice to that, whatever that relationship is. So it might be that you share a source. It might be that you pass binaries back and forth. It might be that you, whatever it is, that matches that relationship.
There you go with your, it might be.
It might be. It always
depends. I think
it
they want some definite.
Don't do it.
The definite guideline is, it depends on the context.
Oh,
there's only a definite.
You're
going
to go there, huh?
I'm going to go there, yeah.
You're going to go there. What's the context?
That depends.
You sound like a consultant. We have another question.
So I was just going to, on the thing there, though. Yep. I call this the framework problem, because you often find it with frameworks. And you might have a framework which you're using among, say, you've got 10 customers, you have 10 different team projects, and then you have your framework project, where like you have some core code that's shared between the customers. What do you do with that? It depends. If the same team of people is the same team that's managing the framework, and there's no dedicated resources working on new framework releases, then it probably makes sense to share that at the source level so that improvements are happening there and then. Now, you can talk about branching and things, and because it's the same team and they're not doing parallel development, then I think what you probably want to do is use workspace mappings to put the source code in alongside your source and have it side by side and just there in source, so whenever you check in, it's just in and it's just done. If it's a separate team managing the framework, or, you know, products between teams, then treat it like an external library and, you know, version those libraries and share those libraries how you want to, either checking them in source control or using a separate library repository.
Or making NuGet packages and
making
it that
NuGet
way.
Packages what and having your own, yeah, exactly.
So what he's saying is that it may not be a package. I just want to make sure we get it captured.
So it might not
for
be a package.
Source code control of the video.
So it might not be a package, and that goes back to what sort of relationship do you have with it? If it's like any external thing. If it's an open source project that I'm going to be contributing back to, then I need to have the source and make my changes and contribute them back. I have a partner relationship with them. If I'm not having a partner relationship, a supplier relationship, then I don't want the source and to do that sort of a thing. And the consumer is not going to be able to give me back patches, because that's part of the point of having a supplier-consumer relationship, is to simplify a lot of those. So pick the relationship first, and then use the approach that matches the relationship.
But it might want... I mean, sometimes I've run into problems where people haven't... They haven't sat down and thought about what relationship they need to have, and so it isn't packaged and things, and it turns out actually, and then you run into a load of problems about, well, we picked up the version that was in development and it broke all our stuff and this is causing us nightmares, and they want to go down some complex, massive branching strategy, and actually it would be simpler to say, no, let's do it with a binary type of relationship.
Yes.
And manage it like that instead.
Exactly. You'll have a problem if you have the wrong relationship. Just pick the relationship that's right for the circumstance, and then use the technology that matches that.
And that implies in so many aspects. Okay, yeah. David,
there's a question in the back.
There's one there as well.
Okay, hold on a sec. Let me run the mic up to you,
and we'll come back.
We'll come back very quick, just to watch Keith's run.
Yes.
So I'm Bill Hayes, and I'm the VSALM Ranger who is leading the team that is writing the branching merging guidance for the VSALM Rangers. Mm-hmm. And our branching and merging guidance is available on CodePlex for download. We do generally write it to focus on TFS branching merging issues, but one of the issues about shared code and dependency management really transcends whatever tools you're using. So I wanted to just make a couple of points. And one is that in a guidance project that we've already published, which is William's project on build customization, there is a section on dependency management which talks about some of the options. And we're using that in the next release of the branching and merging guidance as a starting point to talk about this entire issue. So I'm not going to answer the question today, but what I assert is that I will be answering that question in the next couple of weeks, not necessarily for publication, but certainly if people want to contact me and get sort of my team's latest thinking on dependency management and source code sharing, I'd be glad to share some of that stuff out. The primary thing that we're going to be doing is we're going to be taking the "it depends" and describing why you would do it this way versus why you would do it that way, and what are some of the pros and cons of doing binaries versus source code references. What are the pros and cons of having the source code within your team project versus in a separate team project? How do you deal with issues like you need to be dependent on a specific version of the shared code? There's a lot of questions that need answers to, which we can't do in this session, but I assert that we will try to answer most of those questions in the next release of the branch merge guidance that we're going to publish.
And it's worth mentioning that's on Coplex and is a free project for everybody as well.
So actually, what would help me be if, Bill, if you could give me a link to that, and what I'll do is make sure that ends up in the artifacts that end up on the USB key that we hand out to folks. You're going to give them a link right now, but if you give it to me, then they can...
So I will give it to you, but I'll also tell you the link is www.bing.com. Search on TFS branching rangers, and you'll hit probably in the first two or three a link to the Codeplex. Understand that we've published three versions or so out on Codeplex. Please go for version 3, the latest one. And if you have questions, please feel free to post them on the discussion group. It will get answered probably by me.
That brings up an interesting question about versioning on Codeplex and versioning in the Internet, and how you oftentimes don't find the latest version. You find a previous artifact.
The most popular version.
Yes. Now, I'm going to go to him first because he's been waiting patiently.
And you didn't run as well, which was quite disappointing. safety first, good man.
I'm a believer in keeping branching and merging strategies as simple as possible due to some subversion issues in the past that have left me tainted. What are your takes on branching and merging strategies, and how do you guys approach it?
So my comment would be that your branching strategy should be as simple as possible, but no simpler. So it depends. So, for instance, if you're in a continuous delivery environment where you only have one version ever, it's your production version, you check in, it deploys, branches don't give you anything. If you're in a model where you have multiple releases out in the public, you need to be able to deliver hot fixes on previously released code, and you need to be able to deliver hot fixes on hot fixes and service packs, then branching buys you something. The thing to keep in mind is that a branch is kind of a tax. And it's a tax that you pay at the time you take the branch, for the life of the branch, and again when you merge, whenever you merge. If the benefits that the branch delivers are more than those taxes, then the branch is the right thing to do. If it's not, then it's not.
I would say a branch is like a puppy. Needs a little bit of looking after. That was my old boss, Eric. It just needs a constant love and care. And and the tax analogy is a very good one. You know, branches are for parallel development, and therefore, if you have, like you say, you know, a classic is we've got 2010 Service Pack 1 out there right now. We're working on version 11. We have a 2010 Service Pack 1 branch. We didn't create that branch when we released 2010 Service Pack 1. By the way, come to that in a second. And then we've got the version 11 branch, we've got main, actually, which is where we're developing. When we needed our first, we'd like to deliver a higher quality product, but occasionally a bug slips into our product. Yeah, never mind. So, and then when we had our first, customer support request come in, and we needed to do a patch to 2010 Service Pack 1 to issue a hot fix to a customer, we did a branch from the version, the change set, that we built our 2010 Service Pack 1 from. So we didn't create our branch when we released because we might never have needed that branch. So what's the point of paying the tax for it? As soon as we needed the branch, we went back in time, because it's version control, you can do that sort of thing. We branched from that point forward, you know, from in history, created the 2010 Service Pack 1 branch. We made our fix in the 2010 Service Pack 1 branch. we merged the fix back into main, and then we release and do the builds off 2010 Service Pack 1 branch, and off it goes. So that's where branches come in useful. Where branches get horribly complicated is when you suddenly start doing, you know, massive, like, almost seemingly random, you know, branching strategies just because cool diagrams that come out. And, oh, yeah, you know, I want to do, like, branch per feature. How many people have you got on your team? Well, five. How many times do they work on more than one feature at a time? Zero. How much of those features overlap with each other? You know, never. Well, what's the point in branching, you know?
I have seen people do that.
Oh, I see it all the time.
A branch per feature.
Yeah.
And
yeah. That's a CI build, is what that should be.
Yeah, it's got the issue. Yeah, one of the issues with branching is as soon as you start doing branching, you lengthen all the feedback times for integration. Integration becomes a much longer process. So you don't want to do anything that's going to lengthen the feedback before your integration happens. So in the case of a release branch, that's not an issue because these are two totally separate products, effectively. They just happen to have some common bits in their source. Whereas branch per feature, you're delaying integration, so which means you're going to lose feedback and get more bugs.
Now, we sometimes have it where you're not sure when a feature is going to be finished. You know, and you might want to do a actual release to production every single week, but you might be working on a long-running feature. And I've seen the cases where, you know, you've gone off. There's two ways of handling that. One is you can still build that feature in the main line of code, but you have a little switch that disables it from the end user, and it's never actually in the product. That's one way of working. That simplifies things, but bearing in mind, you've got software there that's not getting ran, and maybe is it being tested properly? Maybe it could have a diverse effect. And someone finds a switch. You know, it depends. If you're running a server-side product, that's great. When you're running products that go out to clients, it can be problematic. So maybe you need to develop that in a branch. But every time, like you say, the more you delay your integration, the more painful that integration is going to be when you do it. So if you really do have to do a feature branch, you know, if you have to separate it off and branch in a feature, then, for goodness sake, take regular merges, forward integration and reverse integration, when you push changes from one branch to another and pull them back down again. Do that regularly. Do that every week. Do that every day. Whatever's good for you to make sure you're getting the regular pain of integration so that you don't delay it too much where it becomes impossible.
Do not let the branch just go onward without its connection back to the main.
You need to have a regular heartbeat.
Absolutely don't.
Even in developer division where our branches have 5 million files, we require our child branches of main to take integrations every 2 weeks, even on branches of that size.
So we do it every sprint, really, you know, and we forward take forward integrations and reverse integrations every sprint and move things up into main.
And note, there is a difference, you know, all of this is good advice for one set of contexts. Mm. when you start doing distributed development and distributed source control, then there's a whole different set of forces at play. You can now use some of these branching strategies without delaying the integration, without paying those costs. And at that point, now branch per feature makes a lot of sense because it isn't actually delaying your integration or isn't actually causing some of the problems. So depends a lot on the context that you're at. There are other solutions.
Yeah, he'd like to make a
comment. I wanted to give a short comment back on the check-in policies because the way that they were implemented, they're actually a slap on the wrist. You did it wrong. Bad developer. So a couple of these check-in policies I've rewritten, and instead of saying you did it wrong, it says, didn't you want to leave a comment and put a text box underneath it? Just like Outlook would say, you're sending an email without a subject. It might not be such a good idea. Mm. And the way it helps people, and it helps people understand better why they're doing it, and it's not as, oh, you did it wrong. And people tend to get, kind of frustrated when they get slapped on the wrist often, and then they tend to find ways around it. But if you say, well, it's a simple change. But
I like that. That's good feedback. It's
encouraging instead of punishing.
Yeah, exactly. I notice you are checking in. Okay. We've got some clip art around.
So I have a comment and then a question. And the comment on the assertion that when you're using a distributed version control system that it takes away the problem of continuous integration, I'm not sure I understand that that's true, that, you know, if you've got two different developers working on their own copies of the branch and they go off into different countries for three-month vacations, they're not integrating until they come back together again.
Correct. It's not guaranteed to get away from to take away the problem. It's that with distributed source control and distributed styles of programming, like you see in a lot of open source communities, you can have massive degrees of branching without it impacting significantly the integration times.
Sure.
But it depends a lot on what you're, on how you're working. That's harder to do in non-distributed source control systems.
Even in a DBCS, you still have to pull regularly
right.
from a.
Yes, you do.
Still pulling regularly.
So I don't want to get into. I just wanted to suggest that it's not simply that a DBCS solves that problem and makes continuous integration happen by virtue of the fact that you're using a DBCS. It does not.
Correct. I agree.
My question. I'm doing a Scrum project. And the rule of Scrum is that at the end of a sprint, I can only ship the features that have met the definition of done. Mm-hmm. I have 8 or 9 people working on my team. Mm-hmm. They're all taking items off the product backlog and starting to work on them. They usually only take those items off the backlog that they think they can complete before the end of the sprint, so that we're pretty sure that by the end of the sprint, everybody will be done. Everything that they've checked in on a daily basis gets merged down into main and released as part of the shippable increment. Suddenly I discover that one or two of my teammates have taken on a product backlog item that turns out to be more complicated and more elaborate than we originally thought. He unfortunately started working on it, or she started working on it, or they both started working on it. And now we've got a bunch of changes that have been checked in. But we get to the end of the sprint, we're not done, we can't ship that feature. As I see it, there are 3 options. You have to do a cherry-pick merge so that you pick only the things that are done. And there's a large risk with cherry-pick merges because you may pick too many or too few change sets, and you have maybe a nightmare trying to get everything to build correctly once you start doing cherry-pick merges. The other is to implement this concept of feature toggling. But when you do feature toggling, what you're doing is you're shipping all of the features, whether they're done or not, and you're simply hiding the ones that are not done. And then you have the problem of, when are you ever going to get rid of those features that were toggled off, or how do I clean up my code so that when I ship it to my customer, I get rid of those toggles and I'm shipping clean code. And the third is to consider maybe a limited use of feature branches, where you begin developing in a feature branch and you check into the feature branch and you merge your feature branches when they're done, but you don't merge your feature branches down until they're done. And that way you don't have any problem with figuring out which change sets to merge. I'd just like a little commentary on what are the options that I haven't mentioned and what are your thoughts about preference.
Those options. I am not going to restate that question.
No, it was in a mic. So of those, I certainly have preferences among those options. I don't know if another option is.
Well, go on. You could
back out the changes.
You can back out the changes, but that's a lot. That's very similar to the cherry picking.
And the main reason this is occurring is because there were multiple change sets. It wasn't a complete feature that went in. It dribbled in over time.
Right, which is,
so
which
the
is
question
good.
Is, you commit often.
Well, but
only if it's complete.
Isn't the question? Well,
no. Why are you checking things into the code that aren't complete?
I would check in anything that is high quality, right. Whether it is complete, whether it is a shippable scope or not. So it's high quality, it works, it's unit tested, it's got the test coverage. It's just not enough of a scope that a customer should see it yet. Fine. By all means, check it in and keep going. And that's where my preference is the toggles. And then usually I have, at any given time, no more than 1 or 2 things under a toggle. You don't need that many of them. Mm. But since I want to be able to release pretty often, I have a little utility that does that, and I just inject the single line of code that calls the conditional and when I'm done, I delete that one call. There's only a couple of them at a time, so it's pretty easy to find usages. You know, when I insert one, I then put a task card up on the board for that story that's to remove it so that I don't forget it. But, I mean, it's, I find it to be pretty low overhead and certainly a lot lower overhead than any of the strategies that solve it in source control.
So one of my, this gets to sort of the heart of Agile there, really. If this is happening a lot, if you're constantly having stories aren't getting done, then rather than develop a complex branching strategy to fix that, maybe
just
make the story
that.
Smaller.
Well, I think that's that point.
Make it
that's,
more
that's
incremental.
Truly what it is that the feature size is so large that it's actually causing the problem.
Yeah, and so you need to break things down. The whole point is to break things down into small, deliverable, incrementally deliverable.
But you should never be checking things into the source code that aren't done.
Yeah.
Unshippable.
No, I mean, hold on a second, okay? I didn't say the feature was done or the story was done. When I have a feature or a story, I break it up into many tasks. When that task is done, it gets checked back into the source code. Okay, that's what I do. And it's shippable at that point in time. I will not put something into the source control system that's not shippable.
But if that task is done, that doesn't mean that the feature is complete.
That is correct. That is correct.
Am I going to have to run a mic up to you? You got to restate his question.
Yeah. Okay. So the question was about you're not feature complete at that at this point. So you need to disable the feature. The question is, do you? We have a disconnect here, and part of the disconnect I think is that we're both coming from the perspective of. How much of a problem is it to have a partially completed scope that is of releasable quality such that it could be supported for a user, especially if you're in a frequent delivery sort of environment? Certainly, when I was working on web services and you're releasing multiple times a day, then does it really matter that I've got in this release a bit of additional code on the server that does not yet have a page pointing to it? No. Does it matter that I have a page that's partially implemented but has no links to it? Maybe, but usually not.
Does it matter that you've got a half-baked feature in a product that's gotten to sit on the shelf for 3 years? Then yes.
Then it does matter.
Then that makes a huge difference.
And then your decision matrix is different.
Right. Exactly. If my next release is 3 hours from now, then I just ship it. If my next release is going to be 3 years from now, well, we've got this whole large set of taxes that we're willing to pay at that point. Mm-hmm. I don't need to assume the feature branching all the time because, say, if I'm going to button something up for 3 years, I can spend that extra time.
Monthly sprints with a release. Yeah. Talk about a three-year development process.
Yeah. I would encourage shorter sprints. Shorter sprints and smaller things.
So we're not going to do 2-hour sprints. We decided to do 4-week sprints. At the end of a sprint, we have a feature that maybe modifies an interface and requires modifications to 10 consumers of that interface. We got the modification into part of it, but not all of it. You can't release the interface without all of it out of a software.
So I think of the poor choices that we have, I think toggling might be...
Well, no, that's an interface thing, so that one is a branching one.
So can you give those conditions under which you just said it would be the toggle?
Sorry.
Because we didn't capture the
question was, if we have an interface and we've changed the interface and then we have 10 consumers of the interface that need to change, well...
Why did that get checked in?
I'd argue that's not...
Yeah, that shouldn't be in source control at all because the system's in a non-working state, right? Yeah, so that shouldn't be checked.
Unless they're not consumers you own.
But yeah.
Yeah, if they're externals.
And if it takes so, and then again, it depends because some of the projects it depends on the working time and we might say you might think a 4-week duration is a long duration. It's actually in terms of hours working on it. They might only be working on the project part time, and so maybe that doesn't make sense. Anyway.
There's more problems there too, but.
Exactly. But anyway, it depends what kind of things they're working on. So. If it can't get done in a short time, then maybe we should look at doing it in a different way that breaks it down and changing the architecture in a way that's frequently deliverable. Well, the key is if you can deliver frequently, then like you say, it's a lot easier to be successful because the risk of implementing something partially is a lot lower. If you implement something and it breaks something else that you didn't pick up in testing, then that's a lot lower because it's very easy for you to ship ship a rollback or ship a fix or something like that. So frequent delivery is good if you can get there.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's call that question done. And we have another one here.
So I guess my question is that it sounds like there's a lot of negative to the branching strategy. It's a tax. It's something that needs 10 or 11 care. And in my experience, that hasn't been the case. Most of the negative comes on the merging side. Like, branching is cake.
The hand in hand.
If you're checking in every time a test passes, you're merging back every time you get those working units, then I've never hit that negative
impedance. But that is the tax you're paying.
And it's... I was wondering why the negative connotation, because like branching per feature or even branching per developer on large teams, 30, 40, 60 people, I've never hit those huge problems where it's this huge tax that it seems to be perceived
as. How long does the branch live?
6 to 7 months-ish.
And how long between merges?
Couple of minutes to 30 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so there's. Yeah. So but that's the real thing. Is it's how much are you impacting the integration time and your approach? If you're doing mergers, taking mergers every 30 minutes, you're not adding much to the integration.
Yeah. You're paying very small taxes that aren't adding up significantly.
And
that. Not really.
Well, I mean, yeah. You're getting the benefit from the developer standpoint of being able to work in basically a silo that if they screw it up, they can not affect everyone else that's running against main or whatever. But my question there is that in context of the committing something that is not, quote-unquote, a shippable feature, it's potentially shippable code, but it's no functional feature to the user, and merging that back into, you know, a shared dev branch or something like that for four or five people that are working on one feature and a separate branch for another set of features... Why is that commit and that merge a bad thing of the potentially shippable?
The way that you're describing it, I wouldn't see it as that bad a thing because it's not impacting the time, the cycle time for an integration. If it starts impacting integration cycle times anywhere, then that's where it starts to get to be a problem.
We've all seen the project where, you know, there's multiple branches. They live for 6 or 7 months and then. Then they need to be integrated. Mm. And that's, you know, the nightmare. Well, actually, it could be worse. It could be longer than 7 months. But, you know, you have a significant integration problem. You've got destabilization of the code because there's multiple changes in different branches. You start using some of those features in TFS that say that line of code came from that branch and that line of code came from that branch and which one's the right one. And it's when you're in that scenario that you start questioning, it's like, well, maybe the branching strategy isn't the right strategy.
The guideline I always use is how long does it take in calendar time between the moment that Jim makes a change and me, the furthest person away on the team, integrates to that change? If he makes something that's going to screw me up, how long does it take before I notice that? And that's why it's all about that integration cycle time. If you've got a small number of branches and are merging each one every 30 minutes in both directions, it's not that much longer than if you were working on main. If you've got these long branches, that's going to be the problem. If you've got more branches, it's going to take longer.
I was going to say, I don't know why we aren't on main in this scenario.
I was going to say, in that scenario, if you've got gated check-in and your gated check-in is running all your tests and all the developer's doing is making the code change, building it, testing it, and then merging it, you might as well just do a gated check-in straight into main, have the build do all of that validation
and use your shelf sets regularly to take, if you wanted, some sort of checkpoint.
So that depends. If you have a strong server-side sort of source control, then I agree.
Yeah.
If, however, you've got a decent distributed source control, then there are some huge advantages to be able to work entirely local box briefly and you know, I get on the train, I work on the bus. You know, you still want to be
regular
pushes and pulls. It's those merges every 30 minutes. Similarly, that means that I can work locally and make some changes that have a red bar right now, commit it, keep going, commit it, and then decide that I didn't like the third thing that I did and go back. So I can do all of these commits that would break my policies normally and still use source control as long as it's purely local. So there are advantages to having, you know, a branch for my own development as long as I don't lengthen that integration cycle time.
And we have a comment here.
So say that you did it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You did your branches wrong. You figured it out after 2 years. You've got 40 of them.
Hypothetically, right?
And you haven't integrated in 2 years.
It's resume time, basically, you know.
And you decide you want to go back. Do you just decide here and now, we have main, we've got the last release, remove everything else and start branching from scratch? Do you start moving stuff around? What's the idea here?
These guys are all looking for new jobs if they're on.
Yeah, no. At that point, you have indebted code, and just like any other code debt, you pay it down. And there isn't going to be, when you start talking about indebted nasty code, there's never any one prescriptive guidance. In some cases, it's best to just delete all the branches except for main and go on with life. In some cases, you need to slowly merge them down until you can eventually get to main. In some cases,
it's a hybrid of those two.
Yeah, it's a hybrid of those two. And so, you know, it's going to depend. Just, you have to look at the problem as a whole and see what you can do to make it less nasty.
But it's good that you need to have it. Yeah, it's good. It's A, you've got to confront the problem, realize what challenges it's giving you, and you've got to know what your goal is. Where do we want to go to? What's going to make sense? And then, like, just like when you're paying off any debt, then decide how do we get from where we are today to where we want to be? What's the easiest and quickest way to get there? Some cases start all over. Often it's you've just got to suck it up and pay that debt down slowly.
Another question here.
So what a lot of customers are doing now is they're building a tool that allows them to merge by work item. Mm-hmm. So they'll log a bug, got a check-in policy, they check something in, they got associated with work item, bug. They want to move a bug from dev to main. They merge that bug and the change that's associated with it to main. Now, it's got its downsides because if you've got many check-ins that cover a long period of time, you might have other check-ins that come along with it by accident. But I was wondering, are you doing any work around a merge by work item and make those merge conflicts maybe a little bit easier so that would work?
So I've been having some discussions internally about this one because I've been trying to decide... I'd like to have a discussion with you offline. We've spoken about this before, a tech ed. Yeah, exactly. I'd like to have a chat with you because I'm still not convinced that it's a good thing, because it's I'm worried it might be an anti-pattern, but I haven't quite worked it through in my head. My worry is about delaying the integration. Mm-hmm.
And randomizing the integration.
Yeah, randomizing it, because you've got things across different change sets, and did this one particular bug, it affected 5 files, and yet the bug over here affected 3. How are you ever going to solve that merge? Is that possible? Yeah.
There's definitely downsides to it. I can imagine where it's difficult. But people are doing that now, and they're taking that chance.
Yeah.
Because the opposite chance is, trying to figure out all the different change sets that associate with the bug, and I want just that to go.
Yeah, we'll talk a bit more, because I'm still trying to figure this one out a bit more. One of the things we do with TFS is trying to encourage what we consider is going to lead you to success in terms of a project. And I've not worked that one through enough yet to figure out if I think it's successful. And I'd like to, if people have got other opinions about merge by work item, then please come seek me out tonight and come talk to me about it. But a lot of the times at TLS, we'll only implement something when we're convinced it's leading you to success. Continuous integration, definitely successful.
The answer of I'm still thinking about it is
fine. Okay, still thinking about it. Okay, yeah. Not yet, and no, we aren't. We're not deliberately working on it because we're not convinced it's a good thing yet. But convince me it's a good thing, and then maybe we'll start working.
It depends. Well, you're still thinking about it.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a question. This is for beginners. If you've got a very simple project or a very simple organization, is the minimum level of branching that I should recommend just develop against main, or should I recommend to establish a dev branch and to never check in anything to main except as it passes like a sprint gate or something like that?
So
name.
Yeah, I did the branching chapter of the TFS book. A little bit of a plug there for you, but yeah.
And you have a link.
Yeah, exactly. tinyurl.com/pro-TFS10. So anyway, in that I had a big thing. A branching strategy of no branches is a perfectly valid branching strategy. But you had a comment there. Should we just check into main? It's a very, very good thing when you create your new team project to create a folder called main, convert it into a branch, and then check stuff into there. Check your solutions into that branch called main. Because when you do that, it then makes it easier later on to be able to, if you want to have a branching structure, to be able to do that without having to move things around. Now, there's a gentleman at the back that disagrees with me strongly on this, if you'd like to take a micro, Tim, because
I can
see
him.
Okay, there we go. So a branching strategy of none is a fantastic branching strategy. And if your organization is simple, then you will have success. And our goal in life should be to make our organizations simple, no matter how complex our organizations are.
Mm-hmm. So in the team I'm in, we actually have a mix. We have some apps that are really simple. It's usually one person working on it at a time. Those apps just have a main branch. We have other web apps where we're having to potentially do patches to production and we've got dev work happening in parallel. You know, there's a lot of churn going on. And for those apps, all we have is main and release. We just have those two branches. And most of our apps are web apps, so we don't need to worry about long-time servicing of multiple releases. But in those cases, just those two branches get us by. It's rarely been an issue. Yeah. When we did try doing things like having a branch for sprint work, main and release, or we tried branching by feature, it never ended well.
There's a lot of agreement on that, especially if you look through the web companies, they have easy deployments. So
I know Bill's got his hand up, but we have somebody here who hasn't asked a question yet.
This is more specifically to the future of TFS and some of the features. Is there a plan to ever support common parent merging? You know what I mean? Like you've got two siblings that have been branched from a parent, but you need to merge from sibling to sibling.
So, question is there a plan to support baseless merging?
Well, it's not necessarily baseless, but because they both came from a common parent. But
without having to go up and then down.
Without having to go up and back down again, in a way, just to merge, because there's some certain cases where I don't want to go up and back down because of releases. But
okay. In TFS today, but that's because we don't support the merge.
But other products do support that. I was wondering if that was something that was on the roadmap for.
So in version 11 of TFS, we've done a lot of work to improve the merge experience. There's a lot of auto merging happens now where if you have a change set that affects, say, the same file, but I'm trying to think of some examples. There are a lot of examples now where it will actually auto-merge for you, whereas previously it would say it was a conflict. Now there's a lot more smarts built in. When I say now, I mean in the future, because it's now for me, because I use it every day. But yeah, there are a lot more smarts to... there are a lot more smarts to make merging a lot easier. However, the one of merging because you looking at the parent and then merging between them, that isn't there today. However, improving the merge experience, making merging easier, reducing the pain associated with merging is something we're striving for. So
one thing I will say is if you are doing that a lot, then perhaps your branches are too fine-grained, or those things probably should be one branch anyway, if it's something you're having to do a lot. Mm. If it's infrequent, then...
That particular feature isn't going to be coming in version 11 is what I wanted to be clear about. So, it's not going to happen in between now and version 11 arriving, unfortunately. But improving that merge experience is something we're strongly looking at. I'm not quite sure where we'll end up on that, though.
So I wanted to comment on the baseless merge first and then checking into main. So with respect to the baseless merge, so that's if you're merging today in TFS between two sibling branches that share a common parent, You can do that. It is a baseless merge, but once you've done the baseless merge, you now have a merge relationship, and all future merges are not baseless. They're based on the point at which you did that first merge. So that's how you create a merge relationship between two sibling or currently unrelated branches.
Thanks for clarifying that as well, Bill, because what I was saying about in 11 making the merge experience more, you know, less painful, in 2010, because it's a baseless merge, in effect, it's merging without any knowledge, really, of the parents, you had a lot of conflicts. In 11, a lot of those conflicts are automatically getting resolved, so you don't see them as much.
Right.
But it's still being treated, as Bill says, as internally it's being treated as a baseless merge. So try it, let me know how it's going, but we do want to improve the experience. So thanks very much for clarifying that.
And so the second distinction is in terms of the philosophy that we have within the branching guidance and the sentiments being expressed on the stage about having a single branch. So in the branching guidance, if you're doing development, at a minimum, we have a main branch and a child branch, which is our development branch, because we have a fundamental philosophy that says you never check into the main branch in our branching structure. You always check into the development branch. So we basically treat our development branch as the trunk in the terminology of most of the people who say just work in the main branch. So what we say is work in your single development branch. And the main branch can be used for stabilizing code from previous versions or from the next version. It's possible to have, say, a hotfix come up into the main branch, and you don't necessarily want that to be in your new development yet. So there are lots of reasons why we have that separation of the main branch and the development branch. We check the code into the development branch. We merge that as frequently as we can back into the main branch, and when we get to the point where we've stabilized our code in main, even while development continues up in the development branch, when we stabilized our code in main, we cut a release branch and we make it read-only, and we maybe make an additional branch for servicing or whatever. I don't want to read the whole branching guide to you, but fundamentally we disagree with the sentiment on the stage that we would just have a main branch and check into it.
So maybe we should continue to disagree some more.
Yeah.
Okay, so because I believe what we described was something very similar to that, and just used just different words. Because I view the development branch as the main branch. Okay. So I have the main branch. I'll do a branch on release if I have to service the release. If I don't have to service the release, I won't even branch it for the
release. Yeah, so if you're in a development phase where you haven't released anything yet.
I'm in the main.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm always in main. I will label it whenever an important thing happens, a release or something else. Mm. And I'll branch off that label if I need to.
So we actually make note of the change sets that builds are done as well, so we don't even bother.
You don't even need to label it.
So that's your label.
Yeah, exactly. The change set is a unique reference to a point in time, and that's atomic. You don't need to worry about dates and times and things, and so yeah.
Yeah, any of that works.
Exactly. You can delete. Yep. You can edit labels. The label is like tagging.
Delete
if you like.
Branch. Yeah.
You can, but you can recover a branch later.
Now, gentlemen, we actually reached the end of our allotted time.
I was having such fun.
All right. Well, you're going to go around to the dining hall. You're going to be there, and there's beer and wine and food, and
then we'll be there.
And Bill will be there, and cage match on the naming.
Branching strategy.
Yes. All right. First of all, I want to thank my panelists very much.